blame it on the hamness. Money, we made it. Yeah, but before we see it, are they taking it? Yes, to make you wanna holler at them home. The way they do your life, to make you wanna holler at them home. The way they do your life. Inflation means there ain't no chance to increase a little bit of finance. And bills, they're gonna pile up the sky. To send that boy off to die. Yes, to make you wanna holler at them home. The way they do your life, make you wanna holler at them home.
Gil Scott-Heron with his cover of Marvin Gaye's Inner City Blues, Make Me Wanna Holler. This is from his acclaimed 1981 album, Reflections. Gil Scott-Heron died on May the 27th, 2011, in New York. He was 62. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And we are going to return to two very important cases that developed fairly recently. Just to let you know, the shenanigans continue in Washington now with the so-called hearings to decide on the appointment of Mike Pompeo, yet another crazy situation in the making. But that's what's happening in Washington, D.C. Donald Trump apparently has been taken to the woodshed, and he's now revising his position, although he's still talking about unleashing missiles in Syria. We'll see how that turns out. But what I want us to do, because this is the way I like doing things, is not to drop a story, but to return to it as often as we can to understand the structure of a story. What is this story supposed to tell us? What are we supposed to learn, even from a tragic situation? And I'm referring here to two very controversial cases occurring fairly recently, and they involve the police killings of Stephon Clark, age 22, by two Sacramento Police Department officers on March the 8th, and the killing of Saheed Vasso, 34 years old, by four New York Police Department officers in the Crown Heights section of Brooklyn on April the 4th. A great eruption of emotion in the immediate aftermath, but there has been a kind of eerie silence. And I want to talk about this. I want to talk about these two cases. And they're at a point where I think we ought to, as a community, the community ought to work on responding differently to these kinds of cases. The routine usually is a catastrophe occurs. Somebody shot, and in the minds of the family, in the minds of the community, it's unwarranted, it's illegal, it's wrong. Okay. Then the question is, what do we do about it? And we see predictable faces starting to appear. In these two cases, we have the Reverend Al Sharpton, who heads the National Action Network, who is a high-profile African-American, and who has been in the heat of community battle for quite some time. Both families here reached out to him because they don't know how to navigate these systems that they know they must fight. They've got to fight them. But there is nobody else in their minds. Sometimes this happens because the families initiate contact. Sometimes it's because Al Sharpton's representatives initiate contact. And it is based on a kind of judgment call. How big would these cases be? How prominent will they be? How well would they serve the civil rights profile of an Al Sharpton? I know it sounds cold, but these are the things that happen. And I'm not condemning anybody, because I also know that when these tragedies occur, the families instantly realize they have no idea what to do. They don't know who to call. They don't know where to turn. But they know that they are in a situation that requires immediate action. There are no other leaders. There are no other people coming forward to help on this matter of dealing with the police and dealing with the system. So they call Sharpton, and he shows up. Now, what are we to understand by that as a community? What is our involvement in this transaction? The community clearly is outraged. It is very angry. It sees that the police, the action of the police was unwarranted. That's their belief. So we have a confrontation developing, and swiftly. But we don't have people who can command the folks in the community to just calm down and let's see what happened here. And let's make sense of what it is we need to do in light of what has happened. Let's first get an understanding of what has happened. There's nobody responsible or handling that kind of choreography. I'm just relating to you how these things routinely occur. So they come in, and now there are so many elements to their coming in. We don't know what the arrangements, financial arrangements are. We don't know what the discussions are about whether the family could afford to pay for these expenses or whatever. But we do know that Sharpton is there, and he is never there on a routine case. It has to have a dimension of notoriety. These cases are going to be in the limelight. And by that I mean these cases will become well known. It is important, as a matter of fact. It's an important part of the arsenal here. High profile, high visibility cases warranting the personal attention of Al Sharpton. And therefore, the case gets added coverage and interest by the media. All of these are factors. We don't know what the arrangements are with the lawyer, Benjamin Crump, who Sharpton selects. The family does not select Benjamin Crump. Sharpton selects the lawyer that he will be working with on this particular case. And soon we see the case shaping up. But shaping up as what? The case is shaping up as a case that should pay huge amounts of money. And now comes the role of the community's anger, the community's concern, the community's outrage. These emotions are mined in order to shore up whatever negotiations are to come. The community has no financial interest in these kinds of cases. They have an emotional investment in these cases. And so Sharpton knows that. And as an astute community organizer, he knows the value of maintaining this. It's a vital assist. Because if he were to walk into a room by himself and with Benjamin Crump, it's just two guys there. The system he has to signal to the powers that be, he is walking in as a representative of the people. I want to stop here for a moment. I am not, let me make it very clear, I'm not condemning anybody. I'm not putting anybody down. I understand the unfortunate set of circumstances that just about everybody finds themselves in when these kinds of cases occur. The family reaches out, Sharpton reaches back. They want him to do something. He tries to do something. You have to give him credit for that. But we also should be learning a lesson all the way, all along the way. We should be seeing the yawning gaps in terms of leadership and the vulnerability of our community because we have no leadership. Sharpton doesn't have to leave New York City where he's earning a living and running his thing, the National Action Network, and he's involved in whatever it is he's involved in. Immediately, his life and his schedule and whatever it is they're all interrupted because now he's put on the spot. We're calling you. We want you to respond. And he responds. But I'm pointing to the fact that he responds because, A, in Sacramento, where this tragedy occurred, there is, or at least the people believe, there is no leadership that could handle this. And that's unfortunate. It is also probably very true. And as I said the other day, is Al Sharpton the be-all and end-all of as an answer to all of this? No, he shouldn't be. I am saying, look at this situation. It has gone on, repeatedly. And the formula now is, when these things happen, call Al Sharpton, which is wrong. The community not only realizes it doesn't have that infrastructure, but it actually refuses to construct one. And this is a vital point, and they can't run away from it. The answer isn't Al Sharpton. The answer is to build your own leadership, your own infrastructure. But in the absence of that, people have to do the next best thing. I understand it very well. But it doesn't negate the fact that in these instances, we see how defenseless our communities really are, and how it is accepted and has been accepted for all these decades that we are totally defenseless. Okay, so Sharpton and Benjamin Crump are on the scene, and they're attempting to do whatever they can to respond to the immediate situation. Let's take some inventory here and understand what they are being called to do. They're being called to absorb the full weight of responsibility. They're being called to leave whatever it is they had going on in their professional and personal lives. Suspend that for a moment and deal with this situation. I don't want to presume, but I think it is highly likely that there are no resources to work with. I mean, just to get a plane ticket to get there, who pays for that? Who provides a place for them to sleep? A place where they could be comfortable to concentrate on the emergency work that they have to do. That costs money. So on top of the demand that they come to the situation immediately, is a presumption that they will also fund it. They will put out money and buy their own plane tickets. They'll book their own hotel rooms. You understand what I'm saying? There is no infrastructure for any of this to happen when you're getting help and people have to subsidize even that to help you. And folks don't understand that this is really not right. Okay, who's paying for transportation? Who's paying for professional services? Who's paying for the independent
a forensic pathologist. Where's that money coming from? The expectation is, well, Sharpton is here and Benjamin Crump is here, we'll just have to figure something out. No, that responsibility is now transferred to the people who are coming to help you. They also have to fund these things. And this is very costly. What I'm pointing to is the total disorganization. It is bad enough when you have these kinds of crises occurring. But look at what it requires the people that who are coming to help you to do. They have to assume much, if not all, of the financial burden of helping you. And people don't understand that. I'm setting aside a bunch of other things right now. I'm getting straight. We're doing a straight analysis here. There isn't an infrastructure that I know of in practically most Black communities that in the likelihood of a major emergency or catastrophe that could get enough resources immediately to get things done. It is a strategic failure of our communities. And it's not like the money isn't there. It is that people are not thinking. Despite the fact of so much evidence that it is likely that these things will be needed. It's a whole different scenario from, say, when Martin Luther King went to Memphis, Tennessee. As poor as that community was, he had a place to sleep. He had a driver and a car to take him where he needed to go. He knew where he was going to be eating. These are the things that a community thinks about. They didn't wait for him to get there to figure out the logistics of all of that. These things are planned, maybe not with the meticulousness, you know, of some kind of a government operation, but the elements are there, and there is some degree of order so that you can do, you're coming in, you're the cavalry, to take on some work. But the first job you have is to work before you work. So we see this as a major weakness. It has nothing to do with the fact that people don't have money. It is that the people are not thinking. Not even in their own interests. They're not thinking. Because in the breach of all of this, where people now have to scamper and put, you know, money together and ask Peter and Paul and Mary and Sue, and you have to raise funds and whatnot, now you open a whole different window in a catastrophe. It's already a catastrophic situation you're dealing with. Now you have opportunists who see a way of running a hustle. It has happened, unfortunately, in the case of Stephon Clark. The young man, father of two little children, killed in the backyard of his mother's home, where he too was a resident. He and his children were living there. All of the confusion, you add up the various pockets of confusion. The incident itself, who is responsible, how that is to be dealt with. You have a family in tremendous distress, right? And you have people coming in to help, and who is taking care of that? They have to take care of themselves while they try to help. I mean, that's not right. But then you have hustles going on. Stephon Clark's brother, Stefante, has been seen all over town with wads of cash and acting silly still. Not only that, he had an interview recently with local media. And what is he talking about? He's talking about his mental illness. And he's talking about his visions about doing things and creating organizations to respond to, look, bottom line, there is no way. And he doesn't understand what he's communicating to the media. He's hustling. And I spotted it the very first day. You saw grieved, but your grief is strategically placed always in the center of a television camera's frame. You got something else on your mind. And people don't understand these intricacies. You know, you have one group of people trying to get things together. That's a huge, huge task. At the very least, they need everybody in line, because now they are about to engage fully with a system that has all the tools, it has all the bells and whistles. And then you have people running off, doing things that they may not know, they may not be aware, that they're actually undermining the work that should yield justice. They're doing their own thing. They suddenly find themselves in the middle of a frenzy, a media frenzy, and they love it. They quickly forget that there is a dead man who is at the epicenter of all of this. You see, it begins to become very, very complicated. It is no longer getting the answer or getting answers about why Stephon Clark was shot and killed in the way he was shot and killed by police officers. In the same way, in Crown Heights, where Saheed Vassell, 34 years old, admittedly, because people in the community knew that he had mental problems. If you look at the tape, produced, one of the tapes produced so far, Saheed runs up on people, runs up to them and runs up on them, and he sticks this object that from far, you could say, looks like a gun or looks like a weapon, and then he moves away, he goes away. What is fascinating when you watch the tapes is that none of the people got excited. None of the people were screaming for help. None of the people were acting in a frenzied way as I would if I felt somebody was putting a gun into my ribs. That was not the reaction at all. So they knew who he was. Okay. We have a person with mental problems. Nobody is denying that. But here's the question. Why was he allowed? Why was he allowed to just do whatever he wanted to do on the street? Why did it not occur to people who by now should be pretty conversant with how the police operate for his own safety? Why was he not in a supervised situation or in a situation that would not have exposed him to this kind of reaction by the cops? This is not blaming anybody. This is just asking the question. You have somebody who is mentally ill. How is it that he was roaming the streets and behaving in this way? Is it not reasonable for people to assume that he was up to no good? He was threatening people. Only people who are familiar with him on those blocks in that neighborhood. Because as I said, in the tapes, I watched the tapes very carefully. Nobody raised an alarm. Nobody reacted the way I would react if somebody comes up to me in a menacing way. They all kind of, you know, just dealt with it because they knew him. And in a sense, that was a measure of protection for both of the people he went up to and himself. People knew who he was. They knew that he was a bit off. And they also knew he had no history of harming anybody. So he went, you know, in this fashion, in a kind of play acting with something that wasn't a gun. It was some piece of metal. But I look at the reaction. In not one instance do you see anybody taking the kind of evasive action that people would take if they were in fact or considered themselves to be in grave danger. Nobody reacted like that. And according to the tape, also, it was like he was joking with them. Because after the confrontation, if you will, after he comes up on them in this play-acting way, neither he nor the people that he accosted in this way had any kind of, there wasn't a sense that something wrong was happening. You know, it was like they understood him and he was playing. But again, people should know. This is the United States of America. This is Brooklyn. And the chances are not everybody would react the same way. And we saw it. One would think that if you are a police officer assigned to community duty, in the same way that the community people knew him, one would expect that the police officers patrolling in that area would know him and know who he is and so forth. But that was not the case. So the question there is, who ultimately was responsible for keeping a watchful eye on Saheed Vessel in a protective way? Who was responsible for that? Well, you could say, well, he's 34 years old. He's a grown man. He has children. And he's been in the community. Everybody knows him and so forth. These are naive suppositions. You have a mentally ill person, a bona fide mentally ill person, and you know how the system historically has responded. Why was he unsupervised? That's a question. You can't just say it's a one-sided issue, that the cops did the wrong thing. The cops did what cops do. The question has to do with what kind of preventive action was given to Saheed Vessel so that there would be no chance of absolutely no opportunity for him to be in harm's way? People knew him on the block. He was well known in the community. I was in New York recently, and friends of mine who met me at the airport, the first place we went was to Utica Avenue, right in the vicinity where this young man was shot and killed. Everybody we talked to, every merchant, his small business and so forth, everybody is just the way, on a cultural level, how we relate to each other in the Caribbean. No problem. But we are not in the Caribbean. And there are people who are in a Caribbean community who have no idea of how Caribbean people live. They have no idea about Caribbean customs. They're cops. And although you would think that part of their training is to familiarize themselves with the community, you will know if you are into, you know, community patrolling, you will know certain characters in the community. You just will know them. That did not work in Saheed's favor on April 4th. So what am I saying here? We have been given enough hints all along the way in every case that I could think of where the community erupted as a result of a tragedy, usually involving police. We've had enough of these things to put something in place. It may not be the best safeguard, but it's something. It's something to help us, you know, to help us and save us again, I'm not blaming anybody. This is life. And we do the best we can with what we have. That's been the rule. You do the best you can with what you have. But we have had enough situations that should be instructing us about what it is we really need to do. And it's as basic as saving ourselves. We have to have some kind of order and structure in our communities and in our homes. We have to have people on board with a plan. Our communities, you know, they're so open and vulnerable to these kinds of tragedies. And they're needless. They're avoidable. In many cases, they are. And we're looking at the wrong thing. It's not about calling Al Sharpton. We know, I already predicted where this is going. And that, too, is as a result of how the community and the families in these communities situate themselves. Understand, you're asking people to drop what they're doing to come and help you. There's no money to offset the costs, and there are enormous costs. They can't keep this going themselves. How much money does it require to collect evidence, to have an independent pathologist do a report? The kinds of money that are required, that's required just to assemble a reasonable and credible argument against the system. All the things that they would likely do to frustrate your efforts that will in turn cost a lot of money. So then when the lawyer says, this is a case that could go on for years, meaning the spending of money can go on for years, there is no legal fund. I'm willing to help, but I don't have that kind of out-of-pocket money. The community has no fund. It isn't organized. So the best that I would do is see if I can hasten a financial settlement. And justice will now be redefined. Justice won't be about who did what, which cop did what, who fired what bullets, who actually was responsible for the killing of this person. That is not a primary objective right now. The primary objective is getting through this case and getting the biggest settlement we possibly can get and move on. Now, that may sound cruel because we have notions of justice, what justice should be. Justice should be a trial. Justice should be identifying the act not as an accident, but a deliberate act to kill a person seen by the police as a danger to the community. We're not talking about what the police manual says. We're not talking on those terms. We're talking on the basics here. There is no money to facilitate all the grand expectations that people have. There is no money to get those things done. There are no people to get that done. So, by necessity, we will now have to redefine the term justice. It's not about getting any particular person in jail, convicted, his job lost, penalties that must be paid. Now, that's where we get justice. This, what will have to happen now, won't produce that. And we cannot deny and we cannot hide the fact of where the community itself is complicit in the eventual denial of justice. We're not organized. We're not willing to fund our justice. And we don't have a plan. What should come out of these tragedies? What are the lessons we should learn? What new approaches should we take when we deal with these kinds of cases? None of that is going on. Who is developing the manual for justice in urban areas? How you deal with a system in the likely event that a police officer or police officers will be the ones who are not protecting the community, but are killing off members of it. We want all these things to happen, but we're not funding it. We're not serious about our worth. And we have two cases here. These are very high-profile cases involving the same individuals, right, who are trying to help. Now, I certainly can be critical, but I have to appreciate a lot of the underpinning realities here. As does the community. The community has to look at ways in which it contributes to many tragedies that occur needlessly. Out of these two tragedies, the community should come together and really understand, as much as they would like to exonerate themselves from blame, the fact is they have a role here. They have a role here. And they should begin to discuss this, to own it. And once owning it, you come up with strategies so that if there should be a major catastrophe, we all know what to do. And the answer isn't Al Sharpton. He can't be everywhere. He cannot be the elected savior. The person you call, you know, when trouble arrives. we have to see, too, that we've developed a very bad habit in our communities. When trouble does arrive, we don't know what to do, because we have not taken the time to prepare, and we have not acknowledged certain realities. Let's say we have an ongoing responsibility to do those things that could help protect the entire community. So we don't have these young men and increasingly young women being taken out in situations that could absolutely be brought down a bit. We don't have to worry about, the police are doing their thing. They got coverage. They've got support. They've got sympathetic ears in courts of law, in departmental hearings. The community itself is failing to account for the things that it ought to be doing to tighten up and not have a community just totally open, totally exposed to these lethal encounters all the time. I just wanted to share that, because we have to look at these things another way. We have to see the instruction here is to get our act together so that we can save ourselves. We need our systems, and we need to implement our systems to assure our safety. Thanks so much for listening and allowing me to express these thoughts. And we can pick them up again, you know, tomorrow, if you wish, during Free Your Mind Friday. In the meantime, stay tuned. Expanding Mind with Eric Davis is up next, and I look forward to talking with you tomorrow. Bye-bye. Natural, the natural factor.